Welcome to Worlds Apart. As the father of Greek tragedy, Aeschylus, remarked more than 2.5 millennia ago, truth is always the first casualty of war. In the case of the Ukrainian war, with its unprecedented levels of censorship and deliberate distortions, truth had been banished even before the interstate hostilities began. But maybe truth or honoring reality could pave the way to peace? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Nikolai Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island and author of The Tragedy of Ukraine, What Classical Greek Tragedy Can Teach Us About Conflict Resolution. Professor Petro, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much in advance for this rather unusual and pretty intriguing look at the Ukrainian conflict.
Well, thank you. I look forward to discussing it.
Now, given your focus on the Greek tragedians, let me quote one more of them, Sophocles, who asserted that all men make mistakes, but a good man yields when he knows that his course of action is wrong, repairs the evil. The only crime, according to Sophocles, is pride. Isn't what your book is all about that... This conflict essentially rose out of hubris of the political elites, which, by the way, ancient Greeks considered as one of the biggest sins.
Yes, but not just this tragedy and not just this war. All wars arise out of hubris, which at the beginning, the middle to the end of the 20th century, we had a number of realist political thinkers, international relations theorists, people like Hans Morgenthau and Reinhold Niebuhr, who highlighted this as a common human flaw and encouraged statesmen of their era, the Cold War, to look beyond it and to compare their predicament during the Cold War to the predicament of their predecessors, including all the way back to the Greeks and Persians. And I think it would be very good for all of us to look back to that example and remember that the lessons that they tried to provide to us, which Professor Richard Ned Liebau, who I relied on a lot in coming up with this concept and applying it, refers to as the tragic vision of politics.
What I appreciate in your book is not only references to ancient literature, but also your geopolitical directness. You're essentially saying that Ukraine was conflicted even before the Russian military incursion began, which is an obvious thing, but it's a pretty bold statement to make in this day and age. How far back do you trace the origins of this war?
Well, in literary and political debates, I argue it can be traced roughly 150 years back. Of course, if you read Ukrainian nationalist historians, it goes all the way back to the origins of Rus and the conflict, which I see, again, a lot of historical analogies and biblical analogies to Cain and Abel and Romulus and Remus and Jacob and Esau, this conflict of two brothers. And so this theme recurs in Ukrainian nationalist historical writings. And the problem, the injustice that they highlight is that the wrong brother got the benefits, and it should have been them. It should have been Kiev, which was the mother of Russian cities, and therefore should have dominated over the great Eurasian landmass, and Muscovy should have been the provincial backwater.
But Professor Petro, as far as I understand your thesis, it's not just a historical grievance, it's actually a lived reality, because as you state in your book, the conflict within Ukraine stems from the state's reluctance to recognize the so-called other Ukraine, the fact that the third of its population consider themselves Russians in terms of their cultural identity and Ukrainian in terms of their civic identity. And I think this is actually a crucial point to emphasize, that these people considered Ukraine as their own country, full stop. Why do you think the state refused to reciprocate by fully accepting their identities, regardless of the language they speak or the books they read?
Because early on, after in the years, roughly decade, I would say, and more, following Ukrainian independence, they made the wrong choice. They made a nationalist choice rather than a civic choice. At the time, the ideas of federalism in Ukraine, which go back all the way to the late 19th century, it was recognized that there was a great diversity in the territory of Ukraine, and that federalism would offer an optimal solution, which had been tried all around the world, basically exchanging freedom of local culture in exchange for civic loyalty, and that that was a perfectly good formula for patriotism. However, over this time, there was a countervailing argument made by Ukrainian nationalists, many of whom drew their inspiration from ancestors who had emigrated to the West after World War II. And it seems that they retained a sense of entitlement to be able to define what is the true Ukraine, even against those who were living in the country at the time. And they brought this sense of entitlement and, to some extent, I would say, vengeance in their hearts for what had been done, as they see it, during the World War II, to their parents and grandparents, and as a result, tried to construct a Ukraine which was more thoroughly and truly purely Ukrainian, which is really a nationalistic Ukraine.
Well, it's not just a nationalist, but it's a pretty xenophobic statement, suggesting that some people living within the country are purer than others in cultural or, you know, bloodline terms. But, and you're pretty explicit in your book about, you know, parking this within Ukrainian elites. But I wonder if it's just their tunnel vision, their own grievances, or do you think perhaps they were also helped by Ukraine's Western allies? Because in the many Greek tragedies, we have, you know, characters who sort of fanned the flames of hostility for their own, usually less than noble aims.
Inevitably. And again, I don't see this particular conflict as different from any other civil war. Most civil wars, I would say all civil wars, have an external component, because there are always neighbors or other forces that would derive benefits from either the weakening of the country that is undergoing this catastrophe, or from a replacement of the old elite with a new elite more sympathetic to them. And Ukraine, which could have been, and is to some extent, I still hope, is destined to be at the crossroads of Europe, it has to recognize itself as a crossroads, as a bridge. But instead, so far has articulated in its among its elites, I would again argue, a sense that we are a bulwark against the East, so an extension of the West, pushing back the eastern part of Europe, which I do consider again Russia to be part of Eastern Europe. I would also say, going back to a bit your earlier point about nationalism, I have a very specific and I hope precise definition of nationalism, which is indeed, it is a form of totalitarianism. I see nothing nothing since the end of the 19th century that ennobles nationalism. Nationalism has been transformed by the 1920s already, and certainly by the 1930s and 1940s, into an instrument of totalitarianism. And it becomes today the only truly effective and resonant instrument of national totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Ukraine being at the crossroads between East and West, and some of our viewers may know that Ukraine's name is literally translated as being on edge or Ukraya. And I personally think that sort of underlines the borderline character of its historic and political development. I've heard some analysts suggest that, you know, those countries that happen to be in between big camps or big civilizations are essentially destined to lean one way or another, rather than trying to sort of cultivate the national identity from within and pick and choose from various corners what they want to utilize. Do you agree with this thesis? Do you think Ukraine has no other choice than you know, joining one side against another, or could it truly develop something, you know, indigenous?
If a country is to have a reason to exist, it does so by doing exactly what you said, by picking and choosing what is indigenous to it and distinguishing that new amalgam from what is being offered to the people across the border. So I disagree with that thesis, because I think Ukraine does exist, should exist, and it is precisely the best option, I suspect, for its future is to find that amalgam of the cultures that are within it and turn it into something unique and flourishing that that would define it in distinction, but not conflict, but simply the difference between itself and its neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Petro, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Nismo imali oružje, nismo spremali neki oružani napad. Mislili smo da to od komšija ne treba ništa da dođe, neko zlo.
Tako jednu večer došli su crnokošuljaši. Jedan po jedan je uzio i mijenjao se na mene, njih osmorica.
Ostao sam u toj kući sve vrijeme dok nisu pobili sve nas, sve stanovnike tog mog sela.
Robljeni Srbi. I dođe jedan muđahedin i odsječe jednom Srbinu glavu. I onda svim ostalim koji su tu, prinosi tu glavu i kaže ljubi brata. I svaki taj Srbin mora tu odsječenu glavu, dakle, da poljubi, pod prijetnjom da će, naravno.
Strane Nasera Orića i većina njih izginula je na svojim kućnim pragovima, slijepo vjerujući u tada, jel, skoro izmaklo bratstvo i jedinstvo.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Nikolai Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island and author of The Tragedy of Ukraine, What Classical Greek Tragedy Can Teach Us About Conflict Resolution. Professor Petro, before the break, we were talking about Ukraine's existential need to find its own unique national identity, its own national selfhood. And many Russian thinkers, including, I'm sure you've heard, President Vladimir Putin, argued that the choice that the Ukrainian leadership has made so far pretty consciously is to, you know, try those authentic limited hostility that existed within the Ukrainian population against the Soviets or later against the Russians and utilize it into a political mechanism of sort of unifying the country from within and attracting Western financing. I can understand, cynical part of me can understand the sort of political necessity or utility of that. But in terms of military and defense strategy, wasn't that reckless? What other country would tolerate a hostile state on its borders, especially when it's armed by the former nemesis of that country?
One of the confusing aspects for analysts of this conflict is that Russia, for nearly 30 years, did tolerate that. So the question in the minds of Western analysts is what changed now? And this is indeed a difficult question to answer, but I think perhaps the answer lies in the sense of the cup of tolerance has been overfilled. And a couple of events of last year, even preceding the offer to renegotiate essentially a NATO strategy, which NATO rejected at the end of 2021. I thought were even more suggestive and indicative of what I underestimated, along with most Western analysts, the degree of the anger of the Russian elite against the Western elite.
But Professor Petro, isn't it understandable that Moscow would wait or try to delay this difficult decision? Because you mentioned this fratricidal war myth. You mentioned Cain and Abel. You know, we consider Ukrainians, you know, not necessarily our brothers, but most of us have relatives there. So for any Russian leader to launch any military operation there, would be a very, very, very difficult choice, both on international grounds and particularly domestic grounds. But I think the Kremlin line has been pretty explicit. The reason they did it was because the West intensified the weaponization, the militarization of Ukraine throughout 2021. Do you believe the Kremlin narrative there?
The way I would say it is politics is not a matter of what I believe. It's what the individual actors believe. And their inability to listen to the other side is what makes conflict happen. So I'm sure that the Kremlin believes what it believes. And in NATO capitals, they believe exactly the opposite and in their own righteousness. And their inability to see beyond that on both sides leads to the, I have to put it this way, the victimization of Ukraine. As a matter of fact, I was thinking the other day how, on the one hand, the West is willing to sacrifice Ukraine so long as it does not join in an alliance with Russia. And Russia feels exactly the same way. Russia cannot tolerate a Ukraine that is in alliance with the West. So the only thing that both sides outside of Ukraine have in common is that they're willing to see the destruction of Ukraine. And that's why if Ukraine is to get out of this situation for itself, it needs to rely on its own internal forces and internal, which means reaching out and establishing domestic unity, which is unfortunately not the policy of the current Ukrainian government.
Not the policy of the current or previous Ukrainian governments, but this is something that your book suggests. I know you see Greek tragedy as a kind of therapy that aspires to restore social harmony. But are you sure that this restoration of social harmony has ever been part of the Ukrainian policy? Because I think, as we have just discussed, they've been aiming for the opposite. What can possibly inspire them to change course for their own good?
Well, there is a significant mythology in Ukraine. I know Alexei Aristovich has recently spoken out against the Ukrainian national hymn. But it actually talks about how we are all brothers in of the same Cossack root. There's a lot of unifying mythology. I talk about Sobornost, which is a concert. They have a day of Sobornost in Ukraine, which is celebrated every year. These good policies, these correct policies striving for national unity, the problem is they have been misinterpreted under nationalism to mean this part is good and national unity will require the destruction of what is unhealthy in Ukraine. And then it becomes simply a matter of targeting and persecuting and eliminating the people who don't match your stereotype. And that will never succeed. That just has never succeeded in human history, and it cannot succeed in Ukraine.
You mentioned the rise of the nationalist or far-right movement, and Russians put it in terms of the Nazi threat, which some in the West believe is a huge exaggeration. But when we actually look and compare the Nazi experiment with what's going on in Ukraine today, I sometimes feel that, what Hitler and people around him did is, some manipulation of the collective unconscious that, they were approaching in an experimental manner, but many of the Ukrainian leaders are very conscious about repeating some of the Nazi practices for misleading their own people, let alone inviting far-right militias from all over the world to gain military hands-on experience of fighting. Now, you can discard all of that as a Russian propaganda, the Nazi part, but what about the fighting potential of those militants? When they come back to the United States, when they come back to Britain, don't they represent a certain danger to your own people?
Yes, but again, I don't think of it strictly in terms of Nazism, because Nazism was not even typical for cognate parties in Eastern Europe and even fascism. There were subtle differences all along the way, even in the 1930s and 1940s. And to draw an analogy of any current political movement to a Nazi movement is simplistic.
Let me clarify my point. I don't try to draw direct analogies, but as you have seen, historical patterns or literary patterns tend to repeat themselves. And if we look, for example, at the Bolshevik movement, the Russians would hate me mentioning Bolshevism in the same sentence with Nazism, but it was a very limited, very radical group that took hold of the entire country and changed its history for many decades. And it started with some nationalist or internationalist ideas, but it quickly revolved into outright violence and repressions and purgings, what have you. And it seems that we have sort of the same dynamic, perhaps of a different proportions, but the same dynamic being used here. Don't you think so?
Yes. But as an academic who does think about these historical patterns and connections, I like to put it in terms of the phrase of a lesser known but more significant historically tendency toward integral nationalism. And so I come back to my fundamental conclusion that nationalism is the evil, and nationalism infects all of us and will continue to do so inevitably so long as we have nation states that prioritize our national interests, our national identity, and our differences with others. Now, I'm not saying that we should just get rid of everything and hold hands and kiss and hug, because that's not going to happen. But it is very possible to live in a world of nation states and recognize its flaws, and to keep those flaws ever before us as warning signals as to what can happen when we exaggerate the importance of national identity.
Mm-hmm. I got you. Now, you also, going back to Greek tragedy as a practical way of resolving tensions or, addressing hostilities among nations. You mentioned that it has a pretty sort of practical layout for how it could be practiced. It consists of 3 points. Agnosis, recognizing tragedy, recognizing your own role in what happened. Catharsis, purging the soul of toxic emotions like vengeance or hatred and sort of freeing the way for more pro-social feelings like compassion. And finally, dialogue, which you define as a form of self-transformation, which allows for a new form of a relationship to take place. I think in this day and age, everything is turned upside down. The most we can hope for at this point is dialogue. You know, bringing the parties to negotiating table. You cannot require them to sort of, you know, go through catharsis or even, you know, take stock of their own actions. Do you think any dialogue could be effective without agnosis and catharsis first?
No. So that sequence has to occur. And dialogue occurs not because two people sit down and say they want to talk, but when they actually feel the need to do so. And the need for that comes from the recognition that, oh my gosh, it's partly my fault, anagnosis. Then, since it's partly my fault, how can I contribute to the healing? That's the catharsis, replacing the rage and hate with emptiness. And then in the emptiness, pity and compassion can come in. And finally, out of that pity and compassion can come dialogue, which enables you to truly see the other person as yourself, mm-hmm. and to recognize your needs in the needs of others.
Mm-hmm. And the humanity of your enemy, which is, I guess, the final, but also a very crucial question here, because I think the Russian culture is distinct when it comes to respecting your enemy, because if you historically look at how much Russians have taken from their, you know, aggressors, be it the Swedes, the Turks, the Tatars, even the collective West after the Cold War, we've always sought to practically approach our enemies and, you know, avail of whatever good practices that they can offer. And I think that's also, you know, partially a consequence of mature state and sort of experiential history, when you know that history is long. Can Ukraine, as conflicted and young as it is, as a state, afford itself something like that? Can it afford to treat enemies with respect? Does it know how to do it?
Without humanizing at least one's fellow citizens, what prospect is there for the state to exist? There is none. You have to develop a constituency which wants to support the existence of that civic culture, both the individual culture, the cultural components of it, the hearth and home, but also the civic identity, the political construct of it. And, you know, as recently as 2020 or 21, I quote President Viktor Yushchenko, who said, well, Ukraine is still a quasi-nation because it hasn't accomplished that. Until it does, it will remain that. And there's no sense in fooling yourself. I sometimes hear from critics who write me and say, oh, this is naive, or on the other hand, this is already, we are now beyond that because the war has united us. War never unites, never. Not, it unites for a very brief moment. And then as soon as that moment is over, everybody's at each other's throats again, unless they can focus on the issues that divided them in the first place. And that's why there is no external solution to Ukraine's problems. It all resides within. And the healing and peace, not just in Ukraine, but I think in Europe as a whole, will begin when Ukraine heals itself.
Professor Petro, we have to leave it there, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
No, thank you, my pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.